I just thought of one more example of the Smith butterfly effect. I have a colleague who, some of you know, is in a residency in psychiatry. And, she's got a patient who has had 10 therapists, probably, and has basically gotten nowhere. And tried all sorts of modalities, and the fellow is very bright, very talented, but feels life is just conspiring against him, and never has really achieved his promise, and he's about 60, I think she said. So she said, well, you need to watch for things coming your way. And so everyone else has worked with him, cognitive behavioral, psychodynamic, you know, cause of that, cause of that, cause of that. So of course she's Jungian, sympathetic. And he said then, reported back, he went to a cafe. He's unemployed, although he's highly educated and highly skilled. Went to a cafe, saw a guy who kind of caught his eye, and was very respectful, but they slowly struck up, you know, a very brief set of conversations. And then I think this fellow had lived in Europe and spoke a foreign language, something like that. That was part of it. And one day, this other guy's girlfriend came in. And he invited this guy to meet her. He invited my friend's patient client to meet her because they both shared this cultural interest. And so they got talking, and she wanted to know a little bit about him, and told her of his background. And she teaches at an Ivy League college, and she said, "We need a faculty with your qualifications." So now he has an interview. See how that small synchronistic, and the question is that going to be enough to break through his crust? But you can see how, where does that come from? An Ivy League job falls right in your lap. That just doesn't happen. So that's an example of how we respect causality, but we're also aware something else is going on, and if we don't pay attention to that, we may miss the opportunity of a lifetime.
Is that Lola?
No, no, that's another friend. Lila is her name.
Lila.
Yeah. Let's see. That takes us to, that goes to 64. 2 points on 60, bottom of 64, 65. Really, these are sort of like detour, or the first one is sort of a detour. How can we know anything is the question she raises after going through all of these examples. And actually, I think it was Pauli who came up with the idea that these models, which, it's not quite, he didn't come up with the idea, but I think he gave flesh to Jung's idea that these scientific models already exist inside us, because the world exists as a reflection inside ourselves as images. So what knowing is, it's linking up that a priori image in ourselves with the event in the outer world. So in other words, the solar system, concentric circles, that's already in us. And then we see facts, and then we match the inner image to the outer situation. So she's just taken her argument of images underlying scientific theories and applying it to a theory of knowledge. That's what she does at the top of 65. And then the next point she makes, which I confess I am still scratching my head about, is the archetype of number. I don't really understand what she's driving at, but even though we did number in time, the best way I can, I always try to think, how do I put this in my own words? what she's saying is we've gotten so far away from being able to visualize something. Like, we can visualize planets going around the sun. But how do you really visualize that the electron is in two places at the same time? It doesn't fit in our categories of perception. So what she's saying is science is moving away from that towards describing things mathematically. Even, I can tell you, even in engineering, those days, there are things about the behavior of electricity which it doesn't make any sense. And the only way to really, you don't ever really understand it, you grasp a mathematical formula to predict the way things happen. So that number, again, becomes more real than any attempt to visualize what is going on. And so she says, maybe we're moving to a place where divine number will be seen as a fundamental aspect of reality. And if I try to interpret that, this is how I think I'd say it. What number does in what she does in Number and Time, those of you who suffered through it, will remember, number shows up in dreams as images of the process of transformation. The unconscious condition in a dream is often symbolized by one. So if you meet one rabbit, one dog, it very likely means whatever that image symbolizes is something that is possessing you, something that's running your life, one way or the other. And as you become conscious of what that represents, it'll split into two. So the image of two, I'm walking on the street, I see twins, I see two dogs, I see two cats, two cars, two leaves, indicates that a process of discrimination has set in. You're no longer contained by that thing or pushed by that thing or possessed by that thing. You are getting a point of view that says, I have this tendency, I can choose something about the way I relate to it. And that then usually leads to a standstill. When consciousness enters in to what was once driving you, what you're left with is a conflict. That conflict can't be solved on your own resources. And what we advise people to do in this state is wait, or as I like to say, actively not do, the wu-wei from China. And if we can endure that conflict, the psyche produces a third, which is the synthesis of the two. So there is a natural progression from one to two to three, which you can watch in dreams as we solve conflicts and achieve a broader point of view that can hold what was once tearing us apart. There's a fourth stage, which I don't want to burden you with too much. There's a fourth stage which comes where that becomes humanized. But the point is, there seems to be this intrinsic 1, 2, 3, 4 process in the psyche. It's what Jung calls individuation.
There's some evidence from case histories that, you know, she calls number an abstraction, which it is, but an abstraction of what? Well, of some primal image. There are people that, when they do a mathematical formula, each number is an image, a shape, a physical thing. And it's always that physical thing. So if they're doing a calculation, they don't do math in their head the way we would. They simply look at the inner world and they see these shapes come up. And each shape represents that number, evidently archetypal image. And they say, okay, the answer is 1, 4, 7, and they can solve any mathematical problem in that way. They don't actually do math the way we do.
One image pops up, which is the answer.
The number.
Yeah.
Well, there is a shape for each single number in the answer.
Oh.
So like one is a certain shape, mm-hmm. two is a certain color, and it's usually color and shape together. So
these would be savants or just, mm-hmm. yeah, savants.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you hear this more than, you know, you hear more than one person doing this. So it's like there's an archetypal background there, which is difficult to translate, and our number system is our abstraction of that abstraction.
That makes sense. Makes more sense.
And it's more understandable
yeah.
to us.
Yeah.
You know, because we've made those symbols, the one, the two, you know, we write the two, we've made those. But they're based on something.
That intuitively that feels right.
Because the Phoenicians made the numeric symbols, first of all, from their mark, from their trading, right? I mean, they're
Arabs, I think. Our number system is. Were the Phoenicians first? I don't know.
What were you going to say?
Well, one was represented an object. One line represented one object. Two represented two objects.
Two lines?
There's a video going around the internet that explains this origin. I'll go through and see if I can find that.
Yeah.
I think I saved it.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. I could be wrong about the nations, but anyway, it came out of trying to make trade.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it came up.
Yeah.
With,
the other thing, what the Chinese characters are for numbers too. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me until now to look at that. You might check that, see if you can find anything on that.
Oh, they're different about numbers. They're very different about numbers. That's about how they affect a different part of the brain. Why did I read this? I think it was my book.
Well, if you do,
okay.
Save it.
It was in Malcolm Gladwell, I think, in one of his books. I'll try to find it. And that, the sliders are different.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of it that it represents, and it goes back to what you're saying, that it represents, that potential, a visual represents a physical object.
The objects
that feels right to me.
Seeing aren't physical objects that we encounter in the everyday world.
Some kind of a symbol?
Well, you might call them blobs with a certain shape and color.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that is something that savants do, because there's a way of teaching kids who are having trouble with math that have dysarthria, which would be just like dyslexia for reading, dysarthria for math, where you use symbols instead of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And they teach them basic math skills based on symbols, like circles and triangles. And
mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just that those of us who aren't good at certain things do it more like, because I think even like kids who are really good at spelling, I don't think they even do that. And I think they have a commitment feel for a word, that's different than just, spelling it out letter by letter.
Different rote memory.
Yeah, just.
I know in Canada they have programs where they teach kids math through dance.
Ooh.
So. Apparently the body, as I met the woman who does that project when last time I was up in Toronto. Let's say when they were trying to talk about, the area of a circle or the circumference, they'll have them roll around the circle. And apparently, with very little verbal instructions, these kids do better on the standardized tests than the ones who go through a classroom mental learning process.
Because it's a body knowledge.
Because it's, I think it gets to what you're saying. It's some of these rest thoughts. Maybe that's why I've always had trouble with that book. But
you need a roll, Gary.
Huh? A roll? We'll have a Jungian roll. not to be confused with a jelly roll. But What I was going to say, which is, I don't know whether it's relevant or not, but if we say numbers are imageless structures, or I don't even think we have to say images, imageless anymore. What I think she's getting at is there is a process of development with certain stages, and those stages are without content. But each life lives the content differently.
Now, what do you think?
Not make sense.
I don't think it's about numbers.
Yeah. One, two, three, four. That there's an inner process to go from one to two to three to four. And for me, one to two to three to four may be about Eros.
Oh, I see. Whatever our content may be.
A content is different. Your content might be aggression or creativity or that process is valueless. And then we live it out in a certain way. In other words, life is a verb, not a noun. And it doesn't, I'm just trying to to express an intuition.
Are you saying that the process goes on in this natural flow? Its variation is by each individual, but the process remains the underlying flow.
So, in other words, I remember, she calls this a projection of a new God image.
The process is?
Yeah. Number is the projection of a new God image. Again, I'm just trying to put this in my own words, and you feel free to contradict or come up with your own way of expressing it. But, in other words, what is sacred isn't the belief you hold. It isn't what you do. It's how you are going through this process.
So, like a primitive man, the circle was his God image. Like, they lived out their life, and nothing really changed that much.
You know,
and they lived according to this sort of unity, and each person lived kind of the same sort of way in the tribe. And now we're in a different era where it's about an evolution, which is this process of divine numbers, mm-hmm. as opposed to kind of a little more static community. So that our God is different than the primitive God.
Exactly.
And that we're living a process instead of living sort of a rounded life that stayed kind of pretty much the same.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, if you talk to a traditional Christian would say, well, my religion consists in believing in Christ.
Yes.
Or a Muslim, my religion consists in following Allah. Or if you talk to a little more liberal Christian, they might say, well, my religion consists in acting justly. Mm-hmm. And this would say the religious life isn't defined by any of those qualities. It's how you transform within whatever you are. That's the new God image. I think that's what she's trying to get at. So that what it does, see, it chops through dogmatism.
Yes, there's not a thing.
There's not a thing, right. There's only you evolving, and your evolving can't make a judgment about the content of somebody else's evolving. Which is what we do all the time, the Christ versus Muslims or Christians versus whatever, you know,
it
Jews.
Like the Tao. Is that another way of saying
it? I think it's another way of talking about the Tao.
Like if you're following your Tao, if you're living your Tao, if you're transforming whatever you need to transform.
Right.
If whatever that may be, I mean, it may be, I mean, it, you know, the Tao who needs to work on the streets, might be, you know, but if she's working through that transformation to the next stage, that's her thing. That's what we can't really evaluate that. We're busy doing our own thing, walking our own Tao.
That's how I would interpret it. What she'd say about that, I don't know. But that's where I try to go with it.
The content doesn't.
Content's not important. It's
whether you're transforming whatever needs to be.
Whatever it is that needs to be transformed. You know. And that will become, I think what she's saying is, that is or will be a new religious myth. So it won't be what you believe in, it will be how you are growing. And now it's what you believe in.
Yeah.
And what your rules are. That's how I understand. This process of abstraction has unobtrusively led to the unconscious projection of a new God image, namely the image of the divine number.
Where is that?
65, the last paragraph.
Oh, okay.
And then, of course, she refers to Pythagoras, where numbers were sacred.
See, that, to me, that leads to holding it like, you know, your group in Carolina that wanted to judge.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like, well, if you really were living your new God image, it wouldn't even come to mind to judge
right.
Jung for what he did
right.
in his life. Or whatever, you know, you would just be focused on your own.
Absolutely.
It was what I need to do.
Absolutely.
And somebody else, I mean, somebody, that's for somebody else to understand, figure out. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the evaluation part of it, or judgment part of it, as to say, is so purposeless,
mm-hmm.
so meaningless, you wouldn't even, why spend energy?
Yeah, why it would be a boring movie.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think it sounds like a weird idea, but the implications are really profound, that it's a way to cut through judgmentalism and dogmatism. So that's why maybe it's worth considering.
And revenge.
And revenge, yeah.
The only thing I'm now getting confused about, on the one hand, we're talking about these numbers like they're like whole numbers.
Yeah.
But when you read through some of this stuff, it doesn't sound like they're talking about whole numbers. They're talking about, you know, probability function.
Well, number as a designator of sequence.
Oh, okay, as a holder of meaning or something.
Mm-hmm.
As the flow.
As the flow, as what designates flow. That's my sense. I'm just trying to put it in my own words.
And also, I mean, the basis of all mathematical models is the series of whole numbers. I mean, you can't have a mathematics without a series of whole numbers. So it's like, if it is a God image, like the underlying basis from which all probability theories is derived. And without whole numbers, none of those equations is even a remote possibility. So it's kind of the building blocks of probability
yeah.
of the series
yeah.
of whole numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for reminding me. I never took Capua.
Okay. That takes her to 66. Still have an age to go? Did we get into some more? Energy. The, you know, basic construct of all physics. Remember the two pool balls? How much energy was in that one pool ball? When it hits another one, is transferred and makes it move. She then just goes through the archetypal historical manifestations of the idea of energy. And some of these I'm not familiar with, so I'll just touch on them. Heraclitus' idea of the world fire. Dakota Indians. Maybe one... 67, yeah. One that's maybe a little closer to our informal language is mana. We say charisma. Same idea. That we have this intuitive understanding. Some people have more energy than other people, or some people evoke more energy from others than other people. And that's the foundation of the concept of energy. Same stuff that we've been doing. She's just going through other... physical concepts.
But that in itself is interesting because it implies a relationship and then it's non-static. I mean, one invokes the other. You know, it's not a static form.
Mm-hmm. And so there, if we withdraw our projection, we don't have to give it a negative evaluation. See how we're kind of sliding over the evaluation of some of these things, but that all belongs to the process of withdrawing a projection. That we realize that energy is not just something out there, it's also something in here.
This parallels the text in the Red Book where between Istvar and Jung, they gather around the secret fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be, yes, right. So that what he's saying, she's saying, is that that physical concept began as a psychological experience, had a psychological meaning. She goes through some other examples, but I don't know if it's that important. So then we sum up a little bit. Now we'll go slower. Page 69, second paragraph. There is therefore no concept fundamental to modern physics that is not in one degree or another a differentiated form of some primordial archetypal idea. That's just a summary of what we've done. Why should we care? Because each theory that has seemed to be inadequate is a chance to withdraw a projection and learn something about ourselves. And very often what is projected, it's the self. Then she comes to a story of the origin of the benzene ring. Do you know the benzene ring?
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain it to us briefly?
What is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just benzene is a solvent, and you know people used to think of molecules as like a little hobby horse, right? You have your little carbon atom, and here's maybe a little glass of alcohol. So it's a little linear molecule, or here it just has a little O over here and a H over there and something like that. So then you have your little molecule. But benzene was interesting because it had too few molecules to be a little hobby horse kind of a structure. So what he figured out was, when he had his little dream, he dreamed with a snake biting its own tail, is it's actually a ring. So it's the first molecule that was known to be
circular. It's the first molecule that was known to be a ring.
It's got six, not five.
Uh-huh.
So it's got six carbons, and then it can have little chains on it and stuff like that. So it had too few molecules to be linear. So how you figure out how were they all connected, and it was something like that. So it's a molecule. It's a ring.
Is it safe to say that's the foundation of organic chemistry?
Correct.
That is the foundation of organic chemistry.
Yes. Those structures.
Okay. And so then, more complex. Organic structures are simply bigger versions of that benzene ring with other things attached to it.
Not everything actually is circular.
But it
did change. Some molecules were found to be circular, which totally changed the idea of like how things could be interconnected. You know, so they didn't understand how molecules could all be connected in certain sequences. So not all complex organic molecules are circular.
They're not all. Huh? Okay.
Would it be safe to say that the change in looking at things from a linear to the ring structure was as big a change as realizing that atoms can, or electrons can be both a particle and a wave? I mean, that is the big change in chemistry.
It's such a big question. That fundamental, certainly it was an amazing concept in terms of how molecules could be connected with each other, you know, which ultimately led to, you know, figuring out what DNA is and all of that. So it did sort of evolve into, without that, organic chemistry, I guess, isn't possible without understanding exactly how molecules connect to each other.
So it might not have been as big, but it was kind of the same situation where the basic of Newtonian physics changed when you got into quantum physics, and the basics of chemistry changed when you understood
them. Yes, like it was the basis of how molecules are connected together, or atoms are connected together to form complex molecules.
And that came out of a dream. That's what, what she wants to make. Again, making a point, several points in one example, how physical theories have a subjective origin, how images underlie physical theories. The guy's name is Auguste Kekulé, I think I'm saying that right. And let's just read what he. This is from his own journal, page 70. On a fine summer day, I went once again with the last bus. So he's coming back to London, I think, from a visit to a friend. I sank into reverie, and the atoms flickered before my eyes. I had always seen them in motion, but I had never succeeded in discerning the way in which they moved. Today I saw how many times two of the smaller ones joined together in pairs, how larger ones embraced two small ones, still larger ones held fast three and even four of the small ones, and how it all rotated in a sort of swirling round dance. When the conductor called out Clapham Road, I woke from my reverie, but I spent a part of the night in putting sketches, at least, of those dream images down on paper. This was the origin of the structure theory. By structure theory, I think he means how atoms...
Correct, how
combined.
Atoms are connected together,
yeah.
Physically.
Then, it was much the same with the benzene theory. Kekulé describes how one evening in Ghent, I think that's Belgium, he was making no headway with his work. I moved my chair over to the fireplace and fell half asleep. Once again, the atoms fluttered about before my eyes. This time, the smaller groups remained modestly in the background. My inner eye now distinguished large formations of varying shapes. Long rows, much more thickly joined together, everything in motion, winding and turning, snake fashion. But look, what was that? One of the snakes caught hold of its own tail, remember the Ouroboros. And the whole formulation swirled mockingly before my eyes. I awoke as if struck by lightning. This time, too, I spent the rest of the night working out the consequences of the hypothesis. So an example of an image and a unconscious contribution to a what you would think is a rational scientific theory. So for the rest of these pages now, well, over to Psyche and Matter at least, she's just stopping for a second and reflecting on what we've said in different words. First paragraph on 71, scientific rational thought often begins with an image. That image is then projected onto a theory. And that's the first paragraph. The second paragraph, the projection is often a God image. So what we're doing in science is projecting onto something. And we think it's a fact until data comes along which shows that it is not accurate anymore, and we discard it. That's her point. Rather than saying, how do we evaluate the way we used to look at things? What's that tell us about ourselves? So that the shift in scientific paradigms can likewise be a source of self-knowledge. So I think it's worth reading that last paragraph. If we compare the above brief outline of the history of the development of a few of the concepts used in physics with the history of religious hermeneutics, we see an apparent difference in that the third stage in the withdrawal of projections, the stage of moral evaluation, seems to be missing in the natural sciences. Page 71, the last paragraph. The third stage in the withdrawal of projections, the stage of moral evaluation, seems to be missing in the natural sciences. In other words, we can say, who is our inner Zeus, who is our inner Aphrodite, and what tricks are they up to, but we can't say, what is our inner causality, and so on. But we need to. I think that's her point. And that by not doing so, we give science a power which has made it dangerous. We no longer see its relationship to ourselves. Go up four lines from the bottom of 71. This has led to that overvaluation of reason and of its product technology, whose destructive consequences, both concrete and moral, we are today beginning to see in the form of problems of pollutions, disturbance of ecology, and so on. In other words, in our scientific and technological minds, all we ask is what is possible. We don't ask what is necessary.
On page 72, that first paragraph, she talks about the archetypes, which she says are never morally neutral powers. How does that fit with the idea of the self as being one?
I think it's saying the same thing.
Could you elaborate on that?
The amorality of the self means that there are, these are dangerous words, morally good and morally bad aspects. And likewise with the archetypes, there are morally good and morally bad aspects. And we have to make that decision. Like Mary Kay was saying, when nature makes an experiment, if it doesn't work, it just goes on to the next.
No judgment.
Which is fine until it happens to be you that it's trying to erase.
But then she says they're never neutral, so they are judging.
Yes. Well,
I think the human experience of them is the unjudgeable by us. You know, like, the fact that we can be destructive, we can have judgment about it. But the self doesn't have judgment about it.
We can't really know, though.
No, we just use our feeling function or whatever to evaluate, you know.
We can't really know the nature of the self and the archetypes directly.
True.
That's what I'm thinking about.
Well, I think you got to look at what the consequences are.
Right. We can only go by what happens.
You can only go by what happens. And hopefully what we're trying to do in our inner work is get a sense of where this thing is going before it plays out its end. But true, you never know for sure.
You can only ask things like, does it give more life, more energy, more vitality, or is it leading to less of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like murder is generally considered a bad idea, but if you murdered Hitler, it might have been a very good idea. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can only judge, like, it could be positive or negative, you know, depending on the consequences. But, you know, like, so then there's nothing that maybe is inherently either way, but the effect certainly, you know, is positive or negative.
I think the two examples she gave, a euthanasia and abortion, is really powerful. Right. Examples of how, well, I mean, because now we're letting people live way beyond what they want to, need to.
And that's creating
that they want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that leads to so much stuff. But we can't, with our Christian, you know, we can't consider anything. And same with the board. I mean, you know, the world is so overpopulated now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the bees don't cooperate with us, we're going to lose where's our water source going to come from? So this, I mean, and Don Collins had always said, you know, our number one problem is going to be overpopulation and how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
So those two examples are so pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we do about that? Because we're definitely reaching our limits.
Yeah. Yeah, you see, we everyone agrees, life is sacred. Mm-hmm. No one would disagree with that. But then, okay, whoops, what about this child conceived in rape? Or, you know, this person who really wants to die, but can't die because hospitals are afraid of getting sued. You know, that's where I think you see the moral ambivalence. And then we have to make a decision. Life as a good value can also be a very bad value. And I'm going to read you the next paragraph too, because here she stops and is reflecting on what we've done. In a way we've said it, but it might be good just to hear what she said. Look at the next the second paragraph on 72. Outmoded models originated in the human unconscious. That's what we've been saying. Scarcely a thought is given to what they might mean psychologically once they are no longer fit to serve as a model in describing the outer world. It is only today when we know that the assumption of the observer is decisively precondition the total results that the question is becoming acute. Recognition of scientific projections has also almost always been occasioned by disturbance of pressing need or an emergency, for example, cancer research or the necessity of finding new sources of energy. In such cases, human curiosity is prone to discover new facts that do not fit the old model and force us to think up new hypotheses, or sometimes a new, more subtle model is born spontaneously in the mind of a researcher of genius. Basically, there's not one essential scientific idea that is not in the end rooted in in primordial archetypal structures. And then she goes on to say, and so is Jung's psychology. And then on 73, the last sentence of that first paragraph, it is a thinking pre-existent to ego consciousness that has created the great themes or primordial thoughts of Western natural sciences. In other words, science is rooted on an image. Okay. Let's just see if we can get this chapter done. And she shifts now. And it's a bridge to the next part of the book. Page 73 just kind of repeats what we've been doing. So does 74, when an order, and in the first paragraph, when an order thus created no longer corresponds to the way things behave, it is then recognized as a projection. But until this occurs, it appears to us simply as true knowledge.
I'm sorry, where are you?
74, the last sentence of the first paragraph.
I think of my father when I was a kid telling me that he liked math, he didn't like English and stuff, because he said he went to, or they told him to write about a rock and he could describe, you know, its dimensions, but he couldn't describe it, you know, like creative writing. But he liked math because it was 1 + 1 = 2 and it was always the same. And I think the whole time we're reading about this, I think, yeah, except it's not.
1 + 1 = 1 and 2. This is the problem, Dad.
And when it says here, true knowledge, my father's very, this was right and everything else was wrong. So
you see how this really does cut through this opinionated certainty, which itself is only half the story. How destructive that is. I mean, I'm sure, you know, those who've been raised with parents like that, it's like there's one way. Mm-hmm. And think about Christianity. Think about conservative Islam. Conservative Christianity, conservative Islam. One right way.
And doubt being the new value.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I can't help but think of what Jung said. He thought love was getting people to benefit out of the doubt.
And truth always contains an allusion to its own opposite.
Yeah.
Same idea. Yeah. 75, again, things we've already said. How the second paragraph after the quote, how the physicists viewing the experiment determines the outcome of the experiment, brings subjectivity back into science and to a respectable position in our worldview. Just a little sentence which I like is that maybe a little bit more than halfway down the first full big paragraph on 75. Inquiry into the preconscious creative processes in the researcher's unconscious is also still largely ignored. How, again, this is an open field for research. Now, to the point which is the end of the book. So, what she's saying is, look at what has been projected. It's what Jung calls the collective unconscious. That's the last paragraph on 75. What, then, is the nature of the collective unconscious? So she's going to go from projecting to what is projected, namely the collective unconscious, now to, in the next chapter, talking about what is the collective unconscious. So I think if you keep this thread in mind, the book will throw you a little less. We've gone from projections to what is projected as the collective unconscious, all these collective images we've talked about, to now let's talk about this part of the psyche from which these collective images emerge. And that will be the next chapter, and it's going to be the next several chapters because she's going to go to several different mythological systems to examine what's the nature of what's projected, namely the collective unconscious. So that's why the next chapter is straight Jungian theory. And then she'll start looking at demons as personifications of the collective unconscious. That will take up almost the whole rest of the book. So projection, collective unconscious, demons, is how the book is going to evolve. So this book on projection really becomes a book about the collective unconscious, because that's what's projected. Just so you don't get lost in the forest. So it makes sense so far? I don't know how much we'll get done next time. How much will we get done today? We almost got a chapter. So we got through 23 pages.
Oh.
Not bad.
Better than two in Redbook.
Redbook's a little slower.
Well, that's still bigger page.
They're much, but yes. That counts as four. Actually, it counts as six. Oh, let's go 10.
Here we have the numbers again.
I know.
I would say you've read up to 94. Why don't you read up to 107? I don't know how long it's going to take us to do these subsequent chapters, but we may only get through one chapter next time, or we may push a little bit beyond it, because it's really not that new. But I think it would be helpful to sit down and really hear, what does Jung mean by the collective unconscious?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it's not an easy concept.
Do you think Yahweh was projecting on Joe?
Definitely.
Okay. And then this world will got in, since we're finishing the scientific.
What is it?
That article I sent you about this world's projecting.
Yeah, didn't I sent that to everybody, didn't I?
Yeah. Since we're finishing the science.
Project. You want to talk about it next week, maybe?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Everyone got it?
I don't know if I did it.
That might have been your pre-DSL days.
Yeah.
I think I've still got it. I'll send it out again.
Okay.
So we'll pick up with that.
Oh, yeah, here it is.
Okay, see you next week.
Hey, Gary, I thought I had copied the lectures from last time. Not the ones that are on the website.
Yeah.
I know that. Is there any way I can get the ones from the Red Book? Do you keep those?
Yeah. Oh, do I keep them?
Yeah. Because you're on like six.
I do keep them, but bye, John. But my DVD burner has crashed.
Oh, okay. Oh.
So I get it fixed?
Okay. When you do, okay. All right. Good. Thank you. Because those were really great.
Scratch, man.
Okay.
Have fun with your projections. They're everywhere. I take them everywhere I go. Thanks, Gary.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Hope it made some sense.
Is this ours, Anne? Is this our handout?
You can take them. You can see them.